0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungine here, 51551 for your texts. Joe at rte.ie, 0818 715 815 for your calls. WhatsApp us 087 184 3709. Brian Kennedy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, Cullum.
The Queen is dead.
Yes, long live the Queen. And of course, we're talking about Tina Turner. My goodness me. I mean, I know she'd been ill for a long time, but still hard to take it in last night when I heard. You know, I really was just so sad about it, because what a force of nature she was.
And when, you know, you talk about it being hard to believe that she was dead, but I mean, that's because you saw her up close and very much alive.
I did in 1996. Cast your mind back, folks. 1996. August, I'm on tour with Tina Turner, opening for her. Me and a group called Toto were her special guests on that Wildest Dreams tour. And it's funny, you know, I nearly didn't get the tour because her manager came to see me open for Clannad, to consider me. And he didn't think I was rocky enough, you know. And he's probably right about that. I would never consider myself a rocker. But my manager at the time, Simon Fuller, was having none of it. He was like, no, we have to get the support slot, because A Better Man was just about to come out. And then suddenly we went into the studio, recorded, put the message in the box, and that cinched the deal. So suddenly I found myself, you know, 10 years earlier, I'd been in a wee squat in North London watching Live Aid on that, you know, July 1985. So nearly 11 years later.
Yeah, her big duet with Mick Jagger.
Yeah, exactly. It was incredible, wasn't it? And again, there we were. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, one day, you know, one day, Brian, you'll get to sing on that stage. And 11 years later, I did. And I uttered the famous line, you know, I have to say it to the audience. Hello, audience. Hello, Wembley. You know, there was a whole big cheer. And we're talking about the stadium. So you're talking about 120,000 people, not just, you know, not just like 10 or 15 or 20. That amount of people. And I watched Tina Turner every single night. I studied her because I thought to myself, first of all, she's kind of like a hurricane in high heels. You know, she just kind of twists onto that stage in glitter, in heels, in hair, you know, all those kind of things. And the voice, you know, her incredible voice, the history of songs, the way that she just absolutely commanded 120,000 people in the palm of her hand. And she had a massive band and dancers and all kinds of things. Honestly, she could have been on the stage on her own. I couldn't take my eyes off her.
And just, I mean, describe that. You call her the hurricane in high heels, the hair, the glitter, the whole bit. What's the noise like when she hit the stage and the response from the audience?
It was like a tribal moment where here we have. Do you remember when she did We Don't Need Another Hero, and she for the movie, the whole kind of gladiator thing? She was like a goddess. And basically, we were her tribe in the middle of this huge stadium, and she was in complete control. She looked otherworldly. She was complete, and that voice ringing around that stadium. It was like old ancient Roman times or something, watching a goddess arrive to take control of the earth for that moment in time.
And
I'll never forget it. And
that kind of a response, that's a response, presumably, to the sheer emotional rawness of her voice and the energy of her performance.
And the idea that, I mean, by then, you know, What's Love Got to Do With It, the movie was coming, all of those things. So people were aware of her incredible struggle to get out of that horrible situation with Ike and to go through all of the lean times and all of that. And then suddenly there she is with the biggest beaming smile. And even when she took it down acoustically and just did, you know, all kinds of little acoustic versions of songs. And, oh, man, it was like, it was just incredible. You know, no matter what she did, she was incandescent. She, like I say, the only way I can describe her is a hurricane in high heels.
And did you get to meet her on the tour, or was it more observing from the wings?
I certainly did. We got the word that Tina would like to meet you kind of three quarters of the way into the tour. So we were lined up, myself and my band and Toto, all lined up like kind of, you know, like schoolboys. And then the limousine appeared at the end of this kind of little track, and the window went down, and there's Tina. She didn't get out of the car. She offered her hand through the window. I leaned over and she said, I'm so glad to have you on this tour. You sound incredible. She was amazing. And then that was it. So that was my brief encounter with her. And then maybe the car would go on another 10 feet and she'd get out the other side onto the steps in the heels, in the silver dress, and go on and basically knock everybody dead for 3 hours, then get back into that car and off she went. Like, it was like she was dropped down from space just for us for a couple of hours, and then there she went back to her galaxy again. It was extraordinary.
And did you watch the footwork? How does somebody cover that much stage in heels of that height at that speed?
Yeah.
Singing at the
you
same
can't
time.
Take your singing at the same time live, you know, and never missing a beat. And I'd say the dancers, she had these gorgeous kind of women dancers on with her who were probably half her age, but my God, they had nothing on her. She had obviously just spent
and possibly
her
twice her size. She wasn't a big lady.
She was a very small, diminutive lady, but like I say, a mini hurricane. You could not take your eyes off the way that she spun around. She belted out the notes. You know, she just took complete control. And then when it became acoustic, like Proud Mary, clearly she was kind of gathering herself a little bit. But my goodness me, the minute she went into What's Love Got to Do With It and Private Dancer and all those incredible songs, I watched her every single night because I knew what a great privilege it was to be able to do that.
And I mean, when you look at the size of her, you know, it, on the science of singing alone, and the ability to get that volume and that power from such a small body, it's almost, you know, you're dealing with almost the impossible there.
Well, I think it's like a war cry. You know, when you're in a situation like that, you shout to the heavens, you sing to the heavens. I mean, she sounded like a warrior to me, you know, an absolute warrior. And to be able to watch her up close like that and just to see her not missing a beat, spinning around, as you say, those high heels. Oh my goodness. I mean, I'm overexcited even now thinking about it. And it was 1996. So, nearly 30 years ago or so.
As you say, there was, you know, the audience response was almost tribal because there were people out there in that audience who may themselves have been survivors of domestic abuse, come across some of the struggles she's had. I mean, I suppose little did you know
that. Right.
In later life, I think post her own stroke in 2013 and cancer diagnosis, she had to relearn to walk. I mean, you're in that tribe.
That's right. Yeah, I am. I had to relearn to walk 3 times in my adult life, absolutely. And I suppose that's the other thing. She was so relatable, you know. Certainly it wasn't lost on me when I was standing in that audience. There was a huge female presence, a huge survivor presence. Somebody who had survived so much with so much grace and dignity and power. That's the other thing about it. She was so powerful towards the end. I mean, I certainly can really relate to the struggle with cancer and all of those things. But my goodness, I have nothing but incredible memories. And what an inspiration to even younger. I mean, you see someone like Beyonce now and clearly cut from that kind of fabric. You know, it's extraordinary. So, yeah, I feel so privileged to have watched her up close, to have met her, to have chatted to her. My goodness me. And as we can see in the media, even last night and today, she affected the entire world.
You're sounding well, Brian. You keeping well yourself this weather?
I'm very well. I'm absolutely well. I'm heading up to Enniskillen to speak and sing at a new integrated school there. And then I'm helping to launch Paul Charles's book tomorrow night in Merrion Skirr at the Literature Festival. So, yeah, very busy. Loads of gigs happening. There's a lovely festival happening out in Dunleary in the Purdy Loft at the end of the month. So gigs are my diary has absolutely woken up. And I'm very, very pleased. And people just want to seem to go out and see live concerts again. Right. And like I say, once you've seen Tina Turner do it, my goodness me, she led the way.
Any room for a Tina Turner song on your own set list?
Absolutely. What's your favourite? Do you have a favourite?
What's your favourite? What one? Give us one that'll take you back memory-wise. What's one that brings it all back for you?
Oh, my goodness. Probably What's Love Got to Do With It, you know. What's love got to do with it? She just sang it so effortlessly. And again, when you hear 120,000 people sing those words, it was just extraordinary. Yeah, I have amazing memories of touring with her. I'm so fortunate.
Well, enjoy them and I suppose commiserations as a fellow musician. Let's hear What's Love from the lady herself.
Yes, please.
Of your hand makes my pulse react. That it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl while the zips attract. It's here. must try to ignore that it means more than that. Oh, what's love got to do with it? What's love but a secondhand emotion? What's love got to do
with it? Well, that's the anthem of anyone who's been through a tough time in a relationship and had a bit of heartbreak, Brian. Does it bring it back to you?
Yeah. Oh, complete. I can see her right now in that silver dress, that big blonde hair, and like I say, the hurricane in high heels taking over the stadium.
All right, Dana Masters, another musician. Tina Turner, what did she mean to you? How are you feeling today?
Hiya. Well, do you know what? I feel super grateful today, if I'm honest. I think that the moment I heard the news, the overwhelming feeling was gratitude that we had someone of her caliber to enjoy not just her music and her performance, but her life and her resilience, because it was such an example to so many people around the world who have gone through difficult times, who maybe life hasn't gone the way you thought it would or you wanted it to, that didn't have to be the end of the story.
And, you know, you've your own beautiful song, Little Girl, which is, you know, the song written in the voice of your mother, trying to tell her daughter how hard life can be. Are those the kind of challenges that Tina Turner overcame that maybe gives people that kind of affinity with her?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember as a very, very, very young girl when the movie What's Love Got to Do With It came out, and for the first time the world saw the things that Tina had to overcome. And I remember thinking as a little girl in Black America that story actually isn't unique. That's a very common story, Tina Turner's story of domestic abuse and all of that. And so for the Black community that I was a part of, this idea of resilience beyond struggle is a common idea. And it was a beautiful thing to watch someone like Tina Turner. I'm sure she didn't love having to live that out publicly in some way, but it was a healing thing, I think, for at least the Black community in America to see that.
Was it harder? Was it harder on her as a Black woman to come out and talk about the domestic abuse situation, having, you know, escaped from one difficult situation and speaking to the wider America that may not have been that sympathetic to her as an African-American woman? It was a risk.
Do you know what? I would imagine it was a risk. What I think is interesting, I don't know if it was harder for her, because I think anybody who suffered with domestic abuse, it doesn't matter what your skin color or any of that. But it was hard for her to, I think, do it, because there weren't a lot of Black women who were talking about that publicly at that time. And so even though it was a common story within the Black community, it wasn't publicly spoken about.
And I suppose there's a difficulty there. She had several institutions to fight. I mean, she was within, you know, an abusive relationship, which is an institution in itself. But Ike Turner, her abusive husband, was far more established in the music industry than she was when she parted ways with him in 1976. She found herself in the wilderness.
She did. Divorcing Ike Turner was more than just leaving a romantic relationship. It was a breakdown of a business that she was in with him. It was a breakdown of a career. And in a sense, it was walking away from a career and her ability to provide for herself. And I think what an incredible story, because I think one of the main things that you would be afraid of in that situation is, where will I go? How will I provide for myself? And so for someone who is so well known to have a story of going, my safety and the safety of my children and my sanity and all this stuff is more important than maybe my supposed success, it's a really powerful thing to have modeled in such a public way.
And the age at which, I mean, she was considering going solo as a career on her own. She played hotel ballrooms, she played, you know, smaller venues in Las Vegas. But for someone in showbiz of her era, a lot of people were written off by the time they were in their late 40s, 50s. It's not a good age for a relaunch at the time
That's
she was a performer.
Even, not even just in her ear. That's just full stop still today. I often say that the music industry as its own machine kind of penalizes women for aging. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know why that is, but it is true. And so I remember I was just I was a very little girl in sort of Tina's heyday, the day that sort of Brian was describing. I was a very little girl, and I remember watching her on television and on videos. And I think the amazing thing is never once did I ever think about her age. She was just this cool woman who embodied for me everything that it meant to be a Black woman, actually, in a time where I didn't really see that on television or even on stages, that fierce, incredible femininity and beauty. You didn't see that in that way modeled a lot. And so as a grown up now, I look back on those times of watching her and never seeing her age, never asking myself how old she was, never even having those types of thoughts watching her. She transcended all of those labels and barriers that the world would seek to put on anybody. She transcended them. She was, in a sense, magical in that way.
And did she inspire you on the showbiz level? Did she inspire you to go upstairs after you saw performances like that, take out the hairbrush and maybe steal your mother's heels? And
I didn't need much inspiration for that at that stage. But I tell you what, I think she subconsciously inspired me. But I think now as an adult, it's a more conscious thing. I mean, I love her music, her voice. Jeez Louise. There's something I think growing up as a little Black girl, I always used to remember listening to singer-songwriters with these angelic voices and just being like, my voice is so rough. My voice is so, you know, and trying to get this like softer timbre to my voice and never being able to. And so to grow up and hear her voice and even to still hear her voice, it just reminds me that the voices we have are the voices we have, and they're powerful and helps me to give value to it. But as a grown woman, I think that even beyond her performance and beyond her music, there is something in the resilience of the Tina Turner story that is just so inspirational and so integral, I think, to who I even see myself to be today. And I feel like I'm still learning from her in that way.
Right. And as you say, that there can be a tendency, I suppose, when you hear people being taught to sing, a kind of a sanitized voice, but the sheer personality, mm-hmm. her entire life experience, I mean, you can hear her life in her voice. As a performer, how important is it to know that you can bring that sense of yourself to your own performance to connect with an audience?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. For me, I perform to connect with an audience. I perform because we all have stories. And sometimes my music is a way to tell our collective story. And so for someone to listen to my music and to my voice and to hear a human being and to hear nuance and to hear not perfection, but character and strength, it's really, really important. I mean, no matter what your voice is, even if you have a beautiful, sort of gentle, angelic voice, there's still that responsibility to bring your whole person into performance, because that connection, that is literally why people were coming to her gigs. They wanted to come and feel the strength, to know that they too could wake up the next morning and continue and be resilient and do the hard things in front of them.
I mean, you weren't short of strong women in your life and inspirational figures and see it to be it type figures, namely your mother. Just tell us about your song, Little Girl, and why you wrote it in that voice.
Yeah, so I actually wrote Little Girl in my grandmother's voice, who's my mother's mother. And she was quite an amazing civil rights activist in our home state of South Carolina. And when my mother was just 9 years old, her and her siblings were the first children to desegregate the school systems in their county. And obviously, that's what an incredible thing to have done, what an inspirational thing to have done. But it was a really hard thing to do. And there were thousands and thousands of other children across the U.S. having to do the same thing. And not every child walked away from that experience whole and okay. That was a very traumatic situation that children would have to do. And so I kind of imagined a conversation that my grandmother or many other mothers and parents who sent their children into those hostile situations, what they would say to their children in hindsight, and sort of process a world in which that needed to happen and why that was the case. And the song Little Girl was born. So it's really a song to my mother and to her sisters and all the other children who carried that very heavy burden on their little shoulders at that time.
And your mother is with us on the line. Sandra Simmons, good afternoon to you.
Good morning.
Okay, good morning. Yeah, in your case, walking into school that day that Dana describes there, I mean, you weren't like James Meredith going into the University of Mississippi in 1962, surrounded by the National Guard. What protection did you have of the institute from the institutional racism in the school system when you went in?
Well, I wasn't her, but because there were no National Guards there to protect us, but I was in a mass of evil and hatred and racism. It was very hard. I was 9 going on 10 years old, and it was very hard for me coming from a school and a community that nurtured us, that really showed pride and taught us pride. And, you know, my teachers from the all-black school would come to my parents' house to have dinner on Sunday. So we were a great family that had good presence in the community, the county. To go to a school, go to another environment where I am just hated. And at 9, 10 years old, I could not understand, even though my mother and father tried to prepare us, I still could not understand that experience because I'm this little girl saying, you know, I am friendly. I am lovable. I can be a friend to just being spit on and hit on and shoved and ostracized and called all kinds of names. Even my teachers did it. So it was a very frightful time. And while
you had been in the kind, nurturing environment of a black school, and then just in order to go to the school nearest to you, you went to a majority white school.
It was an all-white school. I was the only black girl in my class. So,
what year was that, Sandra?
This was in 1962, 63.
And so,
it was a very hard time.
And when you're dealing with who we're talking today, the likes of, you know, Tina Turner and other black icons of the time, how important for a girl like you growing up at that time, how important is it to hear music by performing artists who are African-Americans, who are black performers, who weren't necessarily being put out on the public airwaves? What does it mean to have people like that in the public eye?
Well, your first guest, Brian, said that he looked at Tina Turner as a goddess. And in the black community, she was a goddess to us as well, but she was the goddess of hope. She was a goddess of resilience. She was a goddess of what is possible. So, you know, we were proud. You know, when I was growing up as a little girl back in the 60s, there were rarely black people on TV. And I remember my first time seeing a black person on TV. I mean, we gathered the community to come to our house and look. I mean, it was amazing.
Who was that black person, the first person you saw on TV?
It was Sidney Poitier. And we weren't allowed to watch shows like The Little Rascals or Amos and Andy because there was a lot of racial innuendos on those shows. And my parents protected us from that. They would not allow us to support that kind of stuff. So people like Sidney Poitier and Tina Turner and Harriet Belafonte and Lena Horne, I mean, those are the people that gave us hope. It was almost like the millennials and the Gen X's today, the first black president gave them hope. People like Tina Turner back in the day gave us that hope of the possibility.
And did you keep an eye on her without, you know, looking at the minutiae of her life, but did you keep an eye on her and see the other aspects of her life apart from the music, the magazine covers, the superstar status, the human story behind her? Can you remember maybe when that chimed with you?
Exactly. I mean, I experienced domestic abuse myself. I'm a survivor of domestic abuse. So her story resonated even more with me because here's this woman that's got this tremendous voice and ability, but yet when she was with Ike, she didn't have a voice. And when she divorced Ike and said, walked away and said, "All I want is my name," she reclaimed herself and the strength to walk and reinvent and grow and become a superstar. That's when she blossomed. And that's when she began to be great. I mean, 11, 12 Grammys. I mean, it was in her all along, but she had to reclaim that. And she went through the domestic abuse with Ike and all of that, but yet that did not define her. And that gave women like myself hope and resilience to persevere and know that whatever happened did not define you. It just makes you greater.
And what do you make of Dana's song, that one that tells the story of your grandmother sitting you down and sending you off to school that day and educating you about the unfortunate realities of living where you live, to see her as a performer today? I mean, is that part, do you feel that, you know, her career is inspired and made possible, or certainly made more possible by the likes of Tina Turner?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When Dana wrote the song and let me listen to it for the first time, I was speechless. I told her I could not talk to her at that moment because it took me back to that 9-10-year-old little girl. And what has transpired since then. And so to see Dana today, to stand on stage and just seeing it with such power in her stories, it's just on the shoulders of people like my mama and people like Tina Turner.
Well, here
she is just amazing. I am so proud of her.
And rightly so. And for anyone who hasn't heard it, this is Dana Masters' song, Little Girl. Beautiful, just very, very beautiful and very touching, very personal family story on that. Sandra, do you want to just say a word about the woman your mother was that inspired that song that Dana wrote as a tribute to her?
My mother was such a tenacious woman when it came down to people's rights. And it wasn't just African American, right? She just detested and loathed injustice. And my mother dedicated her life so that other people could have a better life. She instilled in us the desire to serve and to be a good citizen, to be a good American, and that embraced loving everybody.
Just in terms of people who are out there today, you know, we're talking about inspiration, and you mentioned yourself, you're a survivor, you had some affinity with Tina Turner. What would you say to anybody who's in that situation, who identifies with Tina, but maybe just doesn't have it within them yet to take the steps you took to break out on your own for yourself and the sake of your children?
Yeah, it's a hard decision. It's a tough decision. And the one thing, you know, I tried early on to leave and did not have the strength or the courage to do so, and ended up staying 5 years longer than I should have. But within that 5 years, I planned. I had a plan. I could see myself on the other side. I could work toward that. I knew that there was not longevity in that relationship, and I began to emotionally and mentally see myself on the other side. And by doing that, I began to plan and strengthen myself. You know, the 5 years prior to, I did not know if I could do it on my own. I thought I needed that relationship, while so toxic it was. But in that 5 years, I began to get strength and plan and see myself doing it. And then I did. And I knew that the longer I stayed, not only was it going to be bad for me, it was going to be bad for my child. And I loved Dana, and I did not want her to ever think that that was okay.
Well, look, it's clear you've been an amazing inspiration to her and your mother before you. So thank you for coming on and sharing that with us today. And thanks to Dana, not only for her contribution earlier, but also for that beautiful music we were able to play. We'll be back shortly after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
51551 for your text, joe@rte.ie, and you can get us on WhatsApp 087-184-3709. Cullum O'Mungain here. Gráinne Leach, what did Tina Turner mean to you?
Oh my God, good afternoon, everybody. Tina Turner has been my lifelong idol, What a force of nature of a lady. Was an amazing lady, a rock star, a kind woman who always wore her resilient hat in life. And I tried to copy her in life. And I tell my children to wear their resilient hat, just like I do, just like she did. And to be honest, the amount of text message when I heard the news last night, about 10 to 9 on the Facebook page, on Tina's Facebook page, I was absolutely devastated. I wanted the woman to go on forever. I'm actually emotional talking about it. She was meant so much to me over the years. I went to see her many times.
How many times do you think you would have seen her?
I never got to meet her face to face, which was one of my wishes in life. But she rocked my world. She rocked my world. And I like to think I rock people's world as well. And last night I got so many messages saying, when they heard, oh, we're thinking of you, you know, I remind them of, you know, they remind me of her, I remind them of her. And it was overwhelming. I'm, you know, very sad day for the world. I think today...
Why do people associate you with Tina Turner?
Pardon me?
Why did people associate you with Tina Turner?
Well, she's been my idol. I unfortunately lost my arm in an accident some years ago. I had to overcome adversity as well. I used to look to her, as that lady said earlier on, inspiration. She inspired me to get up every day. Her music is fantastic. Overcome adversity.
Would you play her every day? Would you play her music, would you say, every day?
Most days, yeah. I love Simply the Best. And simply, actually, one of my friends actually played that song at our funeral. It was her last song at our funeral a few years back. And simply the best. And then a few years ago, my children play Gaelic football for Ballyboden, St. Enda's. And they were doing a Strictly Come Dancing and a fundraiser pre-COVID. And a friend of mine said, come on, you can do it. I was like, oh, God. I couldn't get up in front of 1,600 people and do it. So they were like, you could. I'd never done that since I'd lost my arm. So I said, right, in her honour, I'll do it, as long as you let me dance to Proud Mary. And I came second with my lovely dancing partner, Danny from Ballyboden St. Enda's. And we came second in front of 1,600 people to Proud Mary.
And so that was the first time you'd gone and done any serious dancing since you lost your arm. I mean, how long of a gap was that?
Oh, well, I lost my arm in 84, so that was, what, 6-7 years ago. There was, get up in front of a stage in front of 1,600 people was pretty daunting. And then we came second, so it was all, oh my God, it was amazing.
And
Tina
got you there, you reckon?
Oh, without a doubt. I even wore one of her gold dresses, the mini dresses. I photographed last night, yeah, loads of photographs on the night.
And did you get the heels on with the dress?
I got the heels on. I got the makeup done, the hair done, the nails done. Last night when I heard in her honour, I changed my profile picture on my Facebook page. I think the world is in mourning today. You know.
You weren't tempted to get the dress back on.
You weren't
tempted to get. You weren't tempted to get the dress back on and sing the hits, were you?
Oh, I definitely am. Actually, my son messaged me from Toronto last night, Mom, your legend of past like you. I was devastated. Yeah.
His
birthday this year, I'll be getting the. He's 30 this year, and I will be doing my Tina Turner dance as usual at the parties.
So, what is the Tina Turner dance? What does that involve? You get the heels, you get the dress. Do you have to get the hair done up big?
It's the knees and the toes, getting up on the toes and doing that special dance she has that I've watched her over the years and I've learned to perfect.
You wouldn't be scared of having another accident, you know, going full at it in a pair of heels, would you?
Not at all. If the heels get too much, I go in the bare feet.
Kick them off. All part of the show.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, private dancer for my family.
But it sounds like, you know, it's been the soundtrack to self-motivation and getting up and getting out and getting on with things for you. So, I mean, it is. It's a poignant. It's a sad day for you.
Very. But I have to say, her resilience in life, the adversities she's overcome. You know, I've seen her movies. My father-in-law even bought me her CDs or, you know, her film, everything at home. And she inspired me. When times were tough in the past, like obviously when you're young and you're sporty and you lose your arm, you know, it's pretty traumatic, but to be able to do something in her honour and to give back, I felt like that night, by giving back, I was doing it, you know, to honour that amazing, amazing woman who is, as I said, I really believe today the world is in mourning and, you know, really, really sad day. Really sad day across the world because you just wanted Tina to go on forever, you know.
And remind us, that song that got you back out on the dance floor for the Strictly Come Dancing.
Oh, Proud Mary. You got to play it for me if you can.
Do you want to hear it?
Oh, I would love to hear it. Thank you so much.
Kick those heels off. Here it comes.
Can I just say one other thing? May she rest in peace. May she rest in peace.
Hear, hear.
Left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day, and I never lost one minute of sleep, and I was worried about the way that things might have been. Big wheel keep on turning, ooh, the Proud Mary keep on burning. Pumped a lot of tang down in New Orleans, but I never saw the good side of the city until I hitched a ride on the riverboat queen.
rolling,
rolling on a river,
rolling on the river,
rolling,
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 rolling on a river.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Cullum O'Mungain here. You can text us on 51551, joe@rt.ie for your emails, and you can WhatsApp us 087 184 3709. Well, on Tuesday of this week, Angelina was in contact with us and she talked us through the daily reality she faces. There isn't a day goes by when she doesn't wake up and consider her own mortality. And she's fearful about dying, not because of the of death itself, but because of what will happen to her 36-year-old son after she's gone. He has an intellectual disability. She has no certainty as to whether or not there'll be a residential place for him in place after she dies. He's in need of high support and nobody has told her what is going to happen when she is unable to care for him anymore, or whether or not a place will be found in time for her to help with his transition from where he is at home now, being cared for full time with all the love and support that he could get in a home. But obviously over time, Angelina's resources physically are going to get more diminished in terms of caring for her son, and she would like to see him transition to a supported residential place before her days are over. And she's not the only person. We were contacted on Wednesday by another slew of people, more people getting in contact as well. Angelina's fear was that she would be alone in this situation. She's not alone in the situation, but I suppose what people are still feeling very isolated about is the fact that they don't have the clarity as to where these services will come from, whether or not they will be funded, and when people will be told. Because in a statement from the HSE, we heard that there are parents in their 90s only just hearing as to whether or not their children, their adult children with intellectual disabilities, have secured a residential place in time for them to begin the transition for that child before those parents ultimately die. Anne, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin.
Tell us about your son.
It's the same story. You could repeat it, the very same. I have a 36-year-old with very complex needs, high dependence, living at home all his life, and no sign of a transition into residential. We've asked and requested, and it's really worrying. I'm 60 years of age. I pray every day that he'll go before me. And it's gone to a stage that I contemplate if I got a terminal diagnosis, if I did. I the worry alone would make me want to have him come with me, die with me.
You would want...
And that's not, it's not a word of a lie. It's because the services, the residential services, it's all crisis driven. There's no planning. There's no such thing as he'll go here for one day, one night a week for the next few months. He can go two nights then. And he's familiar with the staff there, and we're familiar with the house that he'd be going to, which would be huge peace of mind.
And when you say that, you know, you fear for what will happen after you die, when you talk about on some days thinking it would be better if he predeceased you, or even
absolutely
thinking he could come with you, what are you talking about there?
Some sort of euthanasia. As opposed to, we had a meeting and we were told in a crisis, if myself and my husband, who both of us have had health issues this year, heart issues, if both of us died, he could be put in a private facility, maybe up the country, in a big flurry of panic. This would be a chap who lived at home all his life. He'd be put into somewhere with all unfamiliar staff, unfamiliar place. That's unthinkable. It's unthinkable.
And in that situation, I mean, you would contemplate what is, by the law of the land, a serious criminal act.
Yeah, I would prefer him to go either before me, naturally, and if not, it's come in and out of my mind many, many times.
And as you say that, Anne, I mean, did you ever think you'd find yourself saying words like that out loud as a mother?
No, I did not. I have another son and I would crack up if I thought he was to die. But I'm praying for this my older son to die before me. Because it's unbearable to think that his needs wouldn't be properly met in a facility that he's just shoved into because there's a crisis in the health ward.
But those kind of thoughts that are occurring to you, Anne, and it's obviously, they're not thoughts that you would have thought you'd ever have as a mother. Like, what brought you to that point? When did it get that extreme in terms of these kind of thoughts occurring to you?
I suppose I would have thought when he was younger that there'd be a plan in place, that when we pushed on in age, that it would be, oh, let's meet now and let's say this is the house that he's going to go to when we decide you're not able anymore. I suppose the resources in us, and you said that about the other families, the resources are fairly dried up. So within us, because we've been looking after a baby for 36 years, he's 10 months of age mentally. Most families look after a baby for 2 or 3 years and off they go then to nursery and to school and there's no more heavy duty stuff. So when I realised that there was no plan in place for him, that it's going to be a crisis, either somebody dies in the services that he will fit into or we die or get so ill that we can't look after him. No. And then it's a big flurry to find somewhere. And I've been told it could be a nursing home up the country, a private arrangement.
And just explain to people why that's nearly a worst case scenario for you, that somewhere that's far away from where you live, an unfamiliar setting, the kind of distress you feel that would cause your son.
Well, it's like putting a 10-month-old baby into an unfamiliar home overnight with huge needs. No communication, severe epilepsy. It just doesn't bear thinking about, really.
And we did request a response for the minister responsible, Anne Rabbitt, and her office got back to us and said that it's acknowledged, this is a statement, should be said, from a spokesperson, not the minister themselves, but They sent us back a statement. It says, it's acknowledged that demands for residential places exceeds the level of provision, although, as we've heard, you don't need to be told that. It said, the increase in older persons with disabilities living at home with ageing parents is acknowledged. And it says, the preference is to have planned residential placements. However, in recent years, it has been the case that the emergency placements have had to be facilitated, which reduces the capacity to provide places in a planned fashion. And goes on to say, emergency places usually relate to people with very high support needs and have high costs attaching to them.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, from what you're talking about there, your son, he's 36 years of age, he has high support needs and he's the mental age of a 10-month-old. And that's not an emergency.
No, because we're able to do it at the moment, even though both of us have had a stroke last year. My husband has heart issue. And we're not ready to leave him going to residential. And in fact, I wish he never went into residential. But we have to fight to know, could we put some plan in place? And what we're told is, there is none really. And there's a lot hiding behind COVID. There's no respite since COVID, since lockdown. Now, I'm in a better place than a lot of people because I do have care at home, but it's still very, very difficult. There isn't a day goes by that there's not a drama or some sort of putting out fires somewhere or another in the services, not the service he deals with, but in all the ancillary services attached to him.
And both yourself and your husband have had strokes.
No, my husband hasn't had a stroke. He has a heart.
Sorry, you had a stroke and he had a heart condition.
Yeah, I had a mini stroke in September.
And what opportunity did you have to recover from that? I mean, when you're, you know, when you have the care responsibilities you have, where do you get the rest and the recovery time in order to try and come out of that?
There isn't rest in recovery when you have somebody like this in the family.
And are you still suffering the after effects of the mini stroke?
No, I'm not. No, I'm really lucky. I recovered fairly well, but it's not always going to be like that. I'm 61 years of age now. So it's downhill. Health goes, and especially when you're on duty for 36 years, you know, without a holiday, without bar short breaks, a couple of hours away from him, but you're still on duty, you know. But there's no forward planning. That's the really tough thing. And no peace of mind as parents get older that they can say, well, at least he's going to the house up there, up the road, that I know the staff there and I know the setup. That's really, it's very hard to bear, but at least it's at end.
And it's, by the sounds of it, you have asked for a plan or what the plan might be in a situation which you've already had a dry run for. As you say, yourself and your husband have both had health issues. So it's not unlikely this could happen again.
Absolutely, yeah. And funny enough, I'm in the cream of services, people would think. I have a fairly good service here, but there's a lot of gaps and a lot of lack of funding and a lot of not dealing with reality that, and I've no doubt there's people way worse off than me. But if you're able to do it, you're allowed to do it and turn a blind eye.
And over the kind of the last 36 years, Anne, I mean, you say you're in your early 60s, you were in your 20s when your son was born. What's changed in terms of your outlook, in terms of your view of...
There's nothing has changed. When I hear younger parents on, I have a pain in my heart. I really do. 34 years ago, we would have campaigned big time with other parents. We set up parents' associations. We marched in the Dáil. We marched in Cork. We marched all sorts of places. And you know what? Nothing has changed. Very, very little has changed. When I hear of young families trying to get autistic children diagnosed and get services in place.
Why is that, Anne? Why do you think that is? Because, you know, we see instances where people are in dire situations with their homes being affected by, you know, mica and the like, and in relatively short amount of time, billions can be found in when the COVID emergency hit, huge supports, you know, rightly given to people to support employment, to support all of that kind of thing, to buy PPE equipment. What's the difference, I suppose, between the emergency you've encountered and all of those other responses that have generated such a big response?
I'd imagine one part would be that a lot of parents haven't the wherewithal because they're so busy trying to keep their head above water to protest and to attend their TD's clinics and attend. No, we did it at the beginning, but I wouldn't do it now again. I'm not able to do it now. But
you're not able, or you no longer see the point, or both?
I don't. Both. I haven't the energy to do it, and I kind of lost hope. Being honest with you, it's gone on so long, and that's why I would hope that he passed before us. But he's not going anywhere. He's a strong creature, you know. He's too well looked after to go anywhere. But
so you're really at the mercy of other people, other decisions.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. But no forward planning. And over the years, we've been asked, is he going to go to residential care? Filled in all the forms, which were heartbreaking to fill in. Filled in all the forms. Numerous times. And they went nowhere. Obviously, there is some plan somewhere, but there's no money following it.
And as a family, Anne, you know, you say you've another son and you've your husband there and you're talking about the future. As a family, I mean, is there any hope there? What's the What's that conversation
the
like?
The best thing we'll hope for is that, well, I wouldn't wish it on my other son to take care of him. I wouldn't have chosen this life, so I wouldn't expect anybody in my family to look after him, especially a young couple. But I presume what will happen is we'll get so ill one of these days that an emergency place will be found somewhere or other, and he'll be, for all the world, incarcerated there. You know? It doesn't bear thinking about. Death will be easier.
And yet you do have to think about it. This is...
Yeah, yeah. But in thinking about it, we're hearing there's 800 on the waiting list. It has to be a dire emergency. They're only emergency beds. We don't know where he'll be put. It could be a private facility. It could be a nursing home, which is totally unsuitable for his needs. Nursing home is mainly for older people. No, but that's what possibly will be on offer.
Jean Kinsella, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. Thank you for taking our calls. First thing I'd like to say is how difficult it is to have to speak about your family circumstances in public.
And you know what, Jean? I actually have to thank you to come on to talk about it, because I'm sure it's the last thing in the world you or anyone else wants to do and have these conversations. So
it's really difficult, really difficult. I have a beautiful daughter, Sarah, who's 44 years of age. And she has an intellectual disability. She lives at home here with her dad and myself, and we are both in our 70s. Sarah had quite a good life, let's say, up to COVID. But when COVID hit and lockdowns came and her life changed overnight, she had a very bad reaction to it. And for want of a word, she had a breakdown. Her personality has totally changed. Her life has totally changed. She doesn't communicate as well as she used to. She always needed full-time care and attention for everything, for washing, dressing, medical, the whole lot. She needs all that full-time care.
Did she always need that care?
Always needs this care. Well, I suppose you could say all children need care up to a certain age. I mean, she was able to speak to us from, say, 6 or 7. She walked from age 5, and she was very healthy, very, very healthy all her life. She did start in 2000, she developed epilepsy, and she has had a few seizures. She's on medication, which is controlling that very well. But it's this since COVID, and all the
what happened over COVID was it the lack of respite, the lack of day services,
the lack of everything. I mean, it closed down overnight, Colin. When you think about it, like, she went to school one day and she was sent home, and we were told that the school is closed for 2 weeks. You know, to see what's going to happen, and we thought, well, we're closed down for 2 weeks, and then it went on, and it was actually 6 months before she got back to her service. And when she did get back, it was maybe for a couple of hours, a couple of days a week. She also went back to a service where all her friends that she had been with for 12 years prior to COVID were all living in residential. So Sarah was the only service user who lived at home. So she had to be moved to a different service because obviously they couldn't leave her on her own. So she's moved to a different part of the service so she'd get used to new staff and new friends. And it just had an impact on her. She became very hysterical. She wasn't able to sleep. She suffers severe separation anxiety. She just wants me with her 24/7.
Did she sleep, Jean?
She didn't for about 3 months. Literally didn't sleep for about 3 months. She's on medication now, and the medication has helped. And she does... She sleeps fairly well. She wakes a few times during the night, but that's been all her life. I'm used to getting up and going back to bed when she goes back. But she does sleep a bit better than she did. But for three solid months, we had no sleep, none of us.
And sleep is there only due to the medication, effectively.
Absolutely. That's it. And it's actually the only real significant impact that her medication had on her, because it still took her a while to start to try and settle her, to try and get her to go back. She was her services were severely curtailed because of her behavioural issues. She was only going in for an hour at a time, a day. Like, we were leaving her in at 9 o'clock and getting home at 10 o'clock and she was coming in the door behind us. They've eventually stretched it out and she's getting a much longer day. And she's settling in somewhat to day service. She's still quite difficult at home. She still has very bad behavioural issues at home. We cope with them on a daily basis. You get on with it.
Jean, I just hold that thought there because I want to talk to you about that and also for your hopes for the future, indeed your needs for the future and what you'd like to see put in place, something that would alleviate the situation you're in. We just have to take a short break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here, 51551 to your texts, joe@rt.ie for emails and WhatsApp us, 087 184 3709. Jean Kinsley, you were talking to us just there before we talked the break. Before we took the break, you were saying that the impact of COVID and the lockdown and the closure of services and the impact it had on your daughter and the behavioural issues that you and your husband have been dealing with at home and how much worse they've got. And I suppose as time has gone on, your capacity to deal with that isn't maybe what it used to be.
Absolutely. We get older by the day and we've both got all the medical issues that come along with our age group. Life is quite difficult. But the whole point of this whole discussion is that, you know, our family members are being denied their right to live independently, you know, to have their own home, to transition to a home where they have us there to transition them. And as your previous caller, Anne, said, like, we've been told the same. My son was in touch with the HSE and said, what would happen tomorrow if my mum and dad went out tomorrow in the car and got killed? What would happen to Sarah? Oh, she'd be housed. You know, Sarah would be looked after. Like, she'd be put into a facility we planned for. But where? You know, anywhere in the country, as your previous caller said. You know, that's not what we want for our children. We want them to be in a happy environment that they're used to. I mean, we saw the effect that moving from one part of the service with Sarah, moving from one part of the service to the other after COVID, the effect that had on her.
Imagine
her whole life changing, like from her, where she lives, where she's lived for 44 years, happily in a family environment, being well looked after and loved every day, to be sent off to somebody somewhere she doesn't know. You know, it's mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling. And, you know, it keeps you awake at night. You know, it really does. And I have to say, like Anne, your previous caller, it's at the back of your mind all the time. You know, please God, let her predecease me. You know, it's a horrible thought for any parent to have to think. But at least you'd have the peace of mind then. You know, she's at peace. And you could probably, for the want of another word, die happily.
Mm-hmm. And in any of the statements we've got from the HSE, we've got a few of them over the last couple of days, one kind of fairly lengthy one yesterday, but across the board, and also I think in the statement from the minister today, but certainly in the HSE statements, it says the absence since 2007 of multi-annual funding is forcing different service areas of the HSE to procure single placements at a higher cost. In other words, there isn't a multi-annual budget there which would facilitate this planning, but that's been the case since 2007.
Yeah.
Can you understand that?
No, it doesn't make sense to me. As you referred to earlier, when COVID hit, they were able to find funding for everything, you know, throw money at everything. So where was all that money for all these years? Why weren't our people being funded? You know, why wasn't residential being funded and done properly? And Sarah has friends of her own age group who have been in residential for up to 20 years. And at that time, we saw, you know, they transitioned from daycare into their residential home. They could stay there for a night or two and go home and then the next week stay a bit longer. And it went on and on. And are you still there?
Yeah, I am. I'm listening, yeah.
Oh, sorry. No, far from it.
And look, people, I'm not the only one listening to your experience here. There's been plenty of people who've been in touch who are very moved, but also, it has to be said, fairly exercised on your behalf.
As I was saying, friends of Sarah's that went into residential years ago, they had a happy experience, and it was a happy experience for them and for their families. You know, I don't see that happening for us.
And in what we've read, the reports on the National Capacity Review for Disabilities, the figures within that say that it's 20,000 for a day place, which means after that day placement, you know, parents like yourselves provide the care in the home. That's around 20,000 euro now. Those figures may have increased since then, but for a full-time residential place, it's 180,000 euro. So, I don't know, in your situation, you have saved the state tens of thousands of euro in the role you've taken on as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, all of us, all of your other children, I've only got one other son, but you would want for all of your children to grow up, leave home, and have their own lives. You know, certainly not to be living at home with you at 44 years of age. You know, she doesn't have a life outside of here. And when she goes, she gets very little respite, but she does get respite maybe 2 days, 3 days a month. And she's so happy when she goes to respite because she's with people of her own age.
And do you have a life outside of the home, Jean?
Oh, no. I mean, we can't even go on holidays at the moment. We haven't been on holidays since 2019. Because we can't get long enough respite to go away. We can't get a week. We have no life now. We don't have a life together. Let's put it that way. I might have a night out with the girls, or my husband might go golfing with a few of his friends during the day, and that's our social life. But as regards together, before COVID, we could bring Sarah out. We used to go out regularly for an early bird during the week, or go for a drive and go in for Sunday lunch or whatever. But the way with her behaviour at the moment, that's not possible. So we're sort of grounded now.
It doesn't sound like much since the lockdown has changed. I mean, but there's still a lockdown. I think another caller is...
We still feel we're in lockdown. So that's the... the gravity of the whole situation. It's just, and it's every day, you know, it's emails and meetings and phone calls. And it's very wearing. Gets to you. It's tough.
Jean.
And looking at her, it's the toughest thing, you know, looking at her and you know, she's not able to express how she's feeling. She can speak to us now. She can speak. She can have a conversation. Sort of a conversation, but she can't express her feelings, and it's just so difficult looking at your beautiful daughter and, you know, and feeling that she's been neglected and she's become invisible. Very frustrating.
Jean, I know what you said at the outset, that, you know, this is not the place you wanted to find yourself, on the end of a phone line in the afternoon talking about a very private situation. And I know a lot of people out there feel the same. So I can only say thanks to you, and indeed to Anne before you, for coming on this afternoon and sharing that with us and giving people an insight into what the reality is about the absence of this multi-annual funding and the impact it has away from the numbers on real people.
Absolutely, it's people, it's not numbers. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right. And they need to start seeing them as people.
Thank you very much. We'll be back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.